The authorities in Brazil say almost 380,000 people can't go home because of floods. The Brazilian government has released more than $400 million in aid for the victims.
Hello and welcome to the all-new Career Fast Track, the show designed to ensure you make lots of money doing work you love. I am your host, Philippe Desrochers, also known as Dr. Career. You're listening to us at 101.9 FM or online at www.citr.ca. Coming up in today's show, we'll be looking at the secrets to developing an online presence that will catch the attention of employers. We'll also be talking about how you can use LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook in ways you never considered before. Because more importantly, how can you use them in your job search to land great work? We'll first look at the most professional of the three called LinkedIn. And we'll be talking about the tips you can use to create a profile that will get you noticed and also how to use it to make connections that you cannot make anywhere else. Then we will dive further into the latest trend, Twitter. Now, Twitter is much more than a place where you can tell people that you are washing your feet. It is a powerful tool, and the success stories that are coming out about using it to land great work are quite impressive. More specifically, we will look at how you can stay focused on your job search while using Twitter. Later in the show, we will look at Facebook and how you can use the status bar to announce your employment situation and not look desperate. We'll also look at blogging your way to a paycheck. As a whole, we'll also be touching on mistakes people make in their online presence and success stories so that you are convinced of its value. We will also convince you why it is critical that you incorporate this strategy into your approach. Now, if you've not considered using social networking sites or developing an online brand, consider these facts. One, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, an unemployed person in this recession will remain jobless for about 5 months. Can you afford this? Is there any way we can combat this? Two, companies will often look to fill positions before they're even listed. And a website, Slate.com, in their article, How to Find a Job Online, wrote a startling article and fact quoted this, that if a company does post online, it is often a fake listing designed to comply with HR policy, even though they actually plan to fill the job some other way. Well, what other way are they talking about? Thirdly, a survey done by CareerX Rhodes called the Annual Source of Hire Study for 2008, found the top ways that individuals in the United States found work in 2008. Way up at the top of the list, near 40% were internal transfers and promotions. Now, of course, keep in mind, if you are considering a change, an internal transfer promotion is the number one way to find work. The second highest, and this is the focus of today's show, around 30% are through referrals. The efficiency of referrals is one of the single most important characteristics of U.S. hiring practices. Way down at 12% are job boards. The study goes on to say that the most visible trend in 2008 is the presence or the pressure to reduce hires and associated costs attributed to third-party recruiters, newspapers, and traditional job boards. Here's the sentence you've got to remember. A steady growth of sourcing tactics, especially social network and search engine marketing, is also evident. So we're seeing a trend in the area of using social networking, and the stats support it. Now, to make sure you know what is going on in the latest in leveraging these social networking sites, we've brought in our new resident expert on the latest developments in technology and your job search. And there's one thing we know, technology is making your job search easier and more effective. John Horn is the manager for the Early Career Masters program. He teaches Masters of Management students at the Sauder School of Business to land top employment with leading firms in today's tough market. Now, the Sauder School of Business at the University of British Columbia is Canada's leading academic business school. Now, it's also recognized globally for its contributions to management practice through, keep in mind, innovation in research and teaching. Now, his most recent research has led to his development of his latest workshop on managing your online presence. This program includes how to manage personal branding online, how much job seekers and hunters are actually using this medium, then how to manage your online brand for searchability, including blogs and using such sites as LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. He's passionate about edutainment, which combines education, entertainment, and technology in a fun classroom environment. His blog is The Weekly Gumboot, so you will be learning today and also having a lot of fun. In other words, we're fortunate to have him on the show. So glad you could join us today, John.
Thank you very much for having me, Philippe. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, John, how can having an online presence help a job seeker?
Well, if you look at a medium like Facebook, right? If Facebook, if it was a country, it would be the eighth largest country on the planet. Wow. Okay, you take that, say a site like LinkedIn. LinkedIn is going up and up in site hits, like 7 to 9 million hits per month since the recession really hit full force. These are incredibly huge pools of people, of talented people, of people constantly connecting. On top of that, you look at the stats, and the numbers don't lie, my friend. There are a lot of employers that are really taking these mediums seriously and using them to do everything from background check to promote recruitment for their organizations.
Now, listen, what if you are not technology savvy? What do you do?
Two things. One, if you're, say, someone who might have missed the old who might have missed the rise of the internet. Maybe you're in your 40s or 50s, you're a career changer, you're looking for work. I think it's always important to have people in your network that are maybe 10 years on either side of your age. So, long story short, befriend a young person. Take them out for dinner. Maybe share some value with them. Be a mentor and ask them to show their expertise about the internet. People that are growing up today, whether they're, you know, my 12-year-old, 14-year-old cousins or students at a university or a college today, they've got a ton of experience with the internet, with all these social media mediums. They have been, as Don Tapscott says, bathed in bits, right? So they've grown up just immersed in technology. They get it in a good way. The second thing to do, if you really want to take your online presence to a new level, is to befriend a web developer. If you're someone who is really interested in marketing or technology, and you care about these industries, you're really passionate about getting more involved in them, you're going to have an online presence that isn't just there, it isn't just, you know, creative. It needs to look really, really sexy, really, really good. So befriend a web developer. Again, take them out for dinner. Might be a little bit more of an expensive dinner, but that's the kind of two things you can do to really turn this learning curve on technology.
Good. So it's not hopeless for those who don't understand technology.
As you know, Philippe, it's never hopeless. It's always good to be positive and really like think about solutions rather than problems.
Okay. So John, tell me, do employers use social networking sites or search online for information to screen applicants?
So this was you mentioned the workshop, managing your online presence. One of the some of the most fun I've ever had putting together a presentation. This is from a guy who did his grad thesis on cartoons, right? So over 80% in 2008, I should say, over 80% of North American employers, they use online mediums, like use Google or say sites like Facebook to do searches on applicants. Okay, now of the applicants in North America last year who were removed from competition, 43% of those applicants were removed because of findings online. Okay. So nearly half of applicants that were taken out of competitions, it happened because of something that was found online, whether it's a photo of their friends really drunk at a party or some really inappropriate, perhaps sexist, racist, just prejudiced comments written in, say, like a Facebook tagline, something like that, right? This negative things online were removed. And according to a recent survey by Carnegie Mellon, a national survey of youth under 30, so usually between the ages of 15 and 30, in over 50 countries, all of the people surveyed used Facebook, and they said that 25% of those people surveyed had something on Facebook that they would not want their parents or their employer to see. So nearly a quarter of people in this survey, right, under 30 who use Facebook, have something on there they wouldn't want their employer or their parent to see.
So John, it's clear to me that it's not enough to have an online presence, and it's not enough to have a presence in Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. You've got to have the right kind of online presence.
Fantastic point. And the thing that that always sort of surprises me when I do these workshops, I snap to the negative right away. And that's the wrong thing to do. So it's good to sort of present the negative to job seekers, because it really wakes them up, snaps them to attention, and then you got to dismiss it and go to the positive. So it's not just having these scary stats out there about how many people are looking at your application, how many people are looking at your online presence, what could the ramifications be for you. Mm. It's also about thinking of the positive. So how can you improve your Google page rank? So if someone puts Philippe Desrochers, and I recommend everyone go into Google and type it in right now, how far up the page do you come, right? Mm-hmm. How far up the page do I come? And are the things that are written about us, are they positive? And that's really what when you think of the 80% or over 80% of employers screening applicants, that's the kind of that's why they're doing it. That's the thing you want to do. You want to raise up, right?
So you're talking about Googleability. So when someone searches you on Google, they find you. Let's jump into it. LinkedIn,
best thing to use if you want to raise your Google page rank, for sure.
Good. LinkedIn is based on a technology or a concept entitled 6 degrees of separation, which says that there's 6 people between you and anyone you want to speak to in the world. Now, Guy Kawasaki is he's written 7 books. He's actually the CEO of Garage.com and former chief evangelist at Apple Computer. He's all about world-changing innovation, and he wrote a recent blog on using LinkedIn. Very interesting stuff. He says that he will never refer someone who is more than a friend or a friend of a friend, which is 2 degrees of separation. So, John, I understand 6 degrees of separation, but a guy like Guy will not help me unless it's 2 degrees of separation. So here's my first question. How do you get close to important people in LinkedIn, and why would I want to use it?
So, as I mentioned before, LinkedIn is great for, it's basically a social networking site designed purely for professional use, right? So Facebook you have is social, it's to connect friends. Twitter is similar, but on a very rapid fire basis. LinkedIn is for work. So, how to get close to important people? Let's talk first about the search features in LinkedIn. So imagine a database that really streamlines what you're looking for, and it focuses on relevant business trends. So how's a startup company doing, right? Who are the main players in a tech company you really want to get close to, right? And how can you streamline it to find everyone from the marketing department to accounting to the corporate finance division, that kind of thing?
Any success stories that you've seen in your work with individuals?
Absolutely. So a student of mine, we just wrapped up the inaugural Sauder School of Business, Hari B. Varshney Business Career Center job search program. So 21 graduate students at Sauder got together, and they collaborated with each other to help, you know, find work, find employment in this tough market. One of my students, his name's Anton, he used LinkedIn to find most of his contacts. So the point of the job search program was you want to be on the phone talking to key decision makers, people that you can sit down and have an information interview, turn it into an employment interview, get them to start referring you to others, right?
How do you find these people, though? Is there a search area?
Yeah, so Anton would basically take LinkedIn. He'd go into the advanced search mechanism. He'd already, through LinkedIn by going into their news feed and following articles written in certain associations, et cetera. He'd found targeted specific companies in the Vancouver area he wanted to work with. He also did other research as well. He'd go in, he'd plug in the data to that company. So you're talking I want to work at a specific medium-sized technology firm here. Okay, mm-hmm. I want to find the VP of marketing, because I know that's the guy who is going to be the decision maker that's going to help open doors for me. So he would get in there, he'd find the person's name, and it was, you know, fairly easy for him to do, and he did it several times. Then he would assess how far, as you mentioned before, Guy Kawasaki's point of 2 or 3 degrees of separation. So he'd assess how far away he was from this person. If he was 1 or 2 people away, because he's got a growing network, he would ask to be referred. Okay, and if he wasn't, he would take it from Web 2.0, take it from the social media environment online, and he'd pick up the phone. He'd call the organization, and he'd ask to talk to this decision maker. He had a great script prepared, and he had done a lot of research through a medium like LinkedIn as well, and tracked some of the industry trends, tracked some of the decisions this fellow might have made, and then he had a lot of great talking points to use when he talked to him on the phone.
Because he understood a bit of their profile. Because on LinkedIn, you can actually see the profile and the history of an individual mm-hmm. and their work history. And that makes or allows you the ability to connect with an individual and find something in common. Very, very interesting. So using LinkedIn can be done online and used as a tool to do research in order to make direct contact. Because we often say on the show, it's about speaking to the key decision maker, and key decision makers can be identified on LinkedIn. Listen, John, we've got to go to break. But after the break, we're going to talk about actually moving into Twitter. Now, I thought Twitter was simply used for announcing that you're eating some kind of dinner. But in fact, there's more to that. Now, this is an opportunity for you to ask John any questions you may have about how you can leverage these online tools to brand yourself. There are two ways to get in touch with him, by phone and by email. You can call us at 604-827-5370. That's 604-827-5370. Or email us at info@drcareer.com. That's info@dr-career.com. The best time to reach us is during the break. You're listening to a CITR presentation called Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM or online at www.citr.ca. After the break, we'll talk about Twitter. More importantly, we will look at the three things you must do in order to get noticed. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, everybody, I'm home.
Hi, how are you?
Well, tell us everything, sweetie. How's school going so far?
It's great, Mom. I got powerful connections now, thanks to Grandpa.
Chris, I give you a hug, but I'm exhausted from working two jobs to pay your tuition. I've been selling butt scratchers. Butt scratcher?
No, Peter.
Butt scratcher?
Peter, no.
Butt scratcher?
No.
Butt scratcher.
Dad, You got an extra job just to put me through school?
We all did, Chris. Meg and I have been working nights.
I'll take the one on the right.
Well, once again, Meg, I'll be back in an hour.
And I got a job following fat people around with a tuba.
Stop it! Cut it out! I have a glandular problem.
That'll be $60.
Come on, get a life. Spend 6 or 9 months getting involved in communities across Canada.
If you are between 17 and 21, not sure about your next step for college or university, want to meet people from all over Canada, and want to put something impressive on your resume, then listen to Those That Got a Life.
Check out gokatimovic.com. That's go, K-A-T-I-M-A-V-I-K.com. Come on, get a life.
Welcome back to the all-new Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at www.citr.ca. This is the show about making lots of money, doing work you love. I am your host, Philippe Desrochers, better known as Dr. Career. If you're just joining us now, we have been talking about how you can build your online presence so that you can build your brand. More specifically, how you can use Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook and more to get noticed. Before the break, we talked about the most business-focused tool, LinkedIn, and how to stand out among millions of users. We're fortunate to have with us in studio John Horn, a teacher and coach at the Sauder School of Business, where he helps leading business minds land top employment with leading firms. In his work, he has also developed a niche expertise in the area of leveraging technology in your job search. John, I'd like to start with an email we received from a listener. And I'd like your response. About 5 years ago, I returned to Canada from a brief stay in the United States. Upon my return, I needed to get employment. It took 9 months to get a job, albeit one I had no interest in. It's boring and uninspiring. I ended up accepting a position because I was not getting any positive feedback on my results. It's time for a change. So flat out, here's a listener saying, it's time for a change. Now, John, we're talking about Twitter. Is there any way she can leverage this technology?
Well, if you're talking about change, then getting on a medium like Twitter might be the biggest change you could imagine, right? So let's talk a little bit about Twitter, one of the newest up and coming hottest sort of mediums of social media. Since December 2008, to give you a hint, it's gone up. Its usage has gone up well over 300%. And here's my favorite fact about Twitter. So Twitter users, when I first was doing my research, I thought it would be all, you know, 12-year-olds to 30-year-olds, with more of an emphasis on the middle part. So your 19 to 25-year-olds would be using Twitter a lot. But when you look at a recent study done by Social Media Canada, they found out that the breakdown of Twitter users was very similar between people 19 to 35 and people who were about 35 to 50. So if you imagine a pie chart, about half the pie chart was broken down 19 to 35, the other half 35 to 55.
So John, mom and dad are sitting there saying Twitter is not for me, it's for my kids. In fact, it isn't.
So you break down and think of that. I mean, let's focus it on career, right? If you're a job seeker, maybe in the 19 to 35 range, or you're a job seeker in the 35 to 55 range, chances are your bosses could be on Twitter or knows about it and knows it as a medium. So the stats showing that like this medium and this social networking tool is being used by people across the demographics. Let's talk about what are three things you can do to use Twitter to your advantage. One is Twitter search. Okay, so this is a function, the highest rated function for a lot of people will tell you, and it's to monitor brands and trends, right? So people have interesting resources, interesting ideas they're sharing links to. You can follow those trends on Twitter. Number two is Mr. Tweet. Okay, Mr. Tweet. It's a way that you can find new people on Twitter, so maybe that match things that you're interested in. And once again, it's got a very comprehensive advanced search function like on LinkedIn. Okay, so those are two specific examples. Now, still specific, but just a general practice on Twitter. Be authentic and listen to what other people are saying. So be authentic, listen to what other people are saying. With only 140 characters to sort of craft your statement, there is no better place to practice a polished and perfect value proposition. To use 140 characters to tell people how much value you can add to them, to their experience. Okay, so as you're being authentic, as you're listening, make sure that you're sharing information that is relevant, that shows that you have a very creative, interesting, and I got to say it again, authentic opinion on things. One sort of non-success story about Twitter. Recently, in March, there was an article in the Daily Tech, which is a cool blog online newspaper, talks about all sorts of new technological trends. They were talking about Twitter. So this young lady named Connor Riley, she just sort of fell backwards into an internship interview with Cisco Systems. And she was coming back from the interview, and they'd made her an offer. And she said that she was going to be excited to work at Cisco for a fatty paycheck, but she was going to be really bored by the mind-numbing work and the terrible commute from where she lived to their offices in San Jose. And so one of the people that worked at Cisco found this tweet on Twitter, and well, they told her about it. And pretty soon she was retracting the job offer. She didn't get it, and she gained a lot of notoriety, the bad kind of notoriety, for this idea of the Cisco fatty, which is the title she got.
So you have to be critically aware of the words you use on Twitter. In fact, one of the greatest trends is instead of being, it's critical on Twitter to be a follower, but also be a leader. And the way to stand out on Twitter is to put leads or connections to other websites, which will allow you to look like you are a networker, someone who will pass on good information. And others who read this will see that as an opportunity for them to understand that you are, in fact, someone who is a giver and not just a taker. And so we're doing well on time. We're actually down to about 6 minutes here, John. So I want to cover our last few tips, but actually, believe or not, I have to go to break. Things are moving along really quickly. I'm even thinking this is going to go for another segment. So very interesting stuff. So you're welcome to right now. We're taking our break. This is an opportunity for you to reach us and ask John any questions you may have. You can reach him either by phone at 604-827-5370 or email at info@drcareer.com. And so during the break is your opportunity to reach us. You're listening to Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM or online at www.citr.ca. After the break, we will be talking about Facebook and blogs, and more importantly, the simple ways you can incorporate a professional image and how to use the status bar to get noticed. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Right to Play is an international humanitarian organization using sport and play programs to encourage the healthy physical, social, and emotional development of the world's most disadvantaged children. RTP at UBC is run by a team of committed university students who advocate sport for development, and it is the first university chapter of its kind. We want you to get involved. Together, we can educate students about sport for development, help raise money, and teach children here in the Lower Mainland about the importance of sport and a healthy lifestyle. So check us out at www.interchange.ubc.ca/RTPUBC.
Welcome back to Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at www.citr.ca. This is a show about making lots of money doing work you love. I am your host, Philippe Desrochers, also known as Dr. Career. If you're just joining us now, we have been talking about how you can use those ever-popular social networking sites to land the next great job, LinkedIn and Twitter. We're now moving into addressing Facebook and blogs as a powerful search tool. We're fortunate to have with us in studio John Horn, an expert in the area of leveraging technology for your job search. He's a coach and a teacher at the Sauder School of Business at UBC, a leading university in research and innovation. John, Facebook and blogs, how can we leverage them to find opportunities?
Okay, so mentioning before, like Facebook, if it was a country, would be the eighth largest country in the world. Okay, so imagine the connectivity in that space, right? One is for Facebook and using that as to your potential is think about the being a connector. So how can you introduce people who need to know each other, you know, whether they're in your local community or around the world? How can you connect them and you know, build that kind of relationship? So that's a first great part too. And you mentioned before, Philippe, about the having your tagline, your statement in Facebook, and how can it be you can leverage that to say something a little bit more than you're looking for work. Right. So you're looking for certain kinds of work. You've got a lot of things to add. You're sharing ideas. And you mentioned before again with Twitter, sharing resources. So be the person on Facebook who really demonstrates innovation. You're sharing cool links, right? You're referring people to really neat resources, really neat ideas. When you write something in your blog, you link to it in Facebook and you connect and have direct links right out of there. For example, when we do the annual or not annual, but monthly stats for the my blog, the Weekly Gumboot, we find that most of the visits come directly out of people's Facebook accounts. So the people that we sort of connect with, when we write an article, post it in their Facebook profile, and people just can link directly to it from there.
And so I want to highlight the issue of on your profile, in your status bar, if you are looking for work, do not write, "I'm looking for a job." That may come across as desperate. In one case we have in February, Evan Sornstein out of San Francisco wrote, "Does anybody know of anybody who's looking for a website?" And they were actually a website developer. And so you can turn what you're looking for in terms of work into a question that relates to actually helping other people. That led to, actually, it says here, within 10 minutes, she got 4 replies, which ended up leading to an employment. Why, John, we are down to you've got about 10 seconds. Why is a blog important?
So one of my students, Callum Ning, he just became a finalist in the Smart Savvy this marketing competition, advertising competition. And Callum has a fantastic blog. It's called Callum on Media. So number one thing about a blog, make sure you have an opinion, right? Now, second thing about a blog, make sure your opinion is unique, interesting, and I gotta say, positive. If you're gonna be critical, plan solutions. No one likes noise, right? Speaking of noise, a blog should be something that, like I said, is unique, has a positive message, and rises above the millions and millions and millions and millions of other voices on the internet. So what can you do to be very unique, right? To have a very coherent message, right? Usually if you can make it about new trends, about technology, that's very, very cool, very good idea. And also, if you can make sure your blog has a theme like Callum did, Callum on Media, then that's a way to really raise your profile and add value to the experience of other people.
Graveyard secret. John, I always end my interviews with the graveyard secret. This is a question I have for you where you would typically take to the grave, but because I'm asking you so nicely, you're willing to share what your one final thought of the day would be. And if I could ask you to have it be in an action plan format so that you, the listener, can actually apply it in their life, what would your graveyard secret be regarding today's subject of social networking sites and leveraging for job search?
Philippe, because I like you so much, I actually have two graveyard secrets. One, I'll just touch on. It's simple. You can apply it anywhere, but it's take risks. Okay, so in your online presence, calculate the risk versus reward, obviously, but take risks. That's a great way to stand out. Second one, here's the tangible one. It's called link love. Okay, so link love, the concept of connecting with as many different people and spaces and resources online as you can. So for example, if you and your friends are collaborating on a really neat project, for example, I've got some friends I met in when I was putting together a youth employment conference in Kigali, Rwanda. And my friend Edouard, he has used Facebook as a medium to raise the profile of this fantastic idea they have called Safeball. Safeball is about combining music, dance, social activities, and basketball in a way to educate youth in Rwanda about combating AIDS, right? And so he has used Facebook, he's used a blog, and that kind of thing to raise his profile. Not only that, to create link love for Edouard, I posted an article about it on my blog. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, people read my blog, thought it was a great idea. They take that idea and they post it on their blog. So now he's gone from having a one-dimensional connection through a medium like Facebook to multidimensional.
So when you Google him, you're more likely to find him because he's got more connections.
Because more people are writing about him. So okay. Collaborate with your friends. Make link love. Make sure it's clean link love, positive link love, right? But raise each other's profile. Together and as individuals, you'll rise up the Google page ranks and you'll stand out on this massive series of pipes and tubes that we call the internet.
Who knew that Google had everything to do with love? John, thank you for being in studio with us today.
Thank you very much, Philippe. It's been a pleasure.
You can reach him or read about him and his thoughts on The Weekly Gumboot. And John, is there any other way they can reach you if they have any questions about today's show?
They can call you or email Dr. Career.
If you have any questions for John, I will certainly pass them on. info@drcareer.com. This has been a presentation of Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM or online at www.citr.ca. The show about making lots of money doing work you love. I've been your host, Philippe Desrochers, also known as Dr. Career. Next week, we talk about women. More specifically, why they make less money and how they can reverse this trend. My promise is that you will be left empowered. If you've missed any part of this show, please check us out online at www.citr.ca, and you can check out our online podcast to review any missed content. And remember, when you commit to action, the results will follow.
Hi guys, my name is Hafsa and I'm the Public Relations Officer for the International Relations Students Association, also known as IRSA. We have a mandate to provide students from a variety of disciplines with a forum for the discussion of international issues in a casual environment. Our discussions reflect upon all areas of international interest. In addition, a host of other activities, such as diplomatic simulations, academic publications, and conferences such as UBCM-E1, make IRSA the most active student group on campus and one of the most recognized throughout Canada. If you would like to join the club or get in touch for more information, please call 604-822-1604 or visit our website at irsa.ca. Hi guys, my name is Hafsa and I'm the Public Relations Officer for the International Relations Students Association, also known as IRSA. We have a mandate to provide students from a variety of disciplines with a forum for the discussion of international issues in a casual environment. Our discussions reflect upon all areas of international interest. In addition, a host of other activities, such as diplomatic simulations, academic publications, and conferences such as UBCM-U1, make IRSA the most active student group on campus and one of the most recognized throughout Canada. If you would like to join the club or get in touch for more information, please call 604-822-1604 or visit our website at irsa.ca.
GMT, you're listening to World Briefing.
The UBC Learning Exchange Trek program wants you to get involved in your community.
The Security Council
learn about
has held an emergency meeting in New York to discuss how to respond to North Korea's latest nuclear test. Russia estimates that the underground explosion was as powerful as the bomb dropped on Nagasaki in Japan in 1945. Moscow's ambassador to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, said the Security Council had voiced strong condemnation on the nuclear test.
This is a very rare occurrence, as you know, and it goes contrary not only to resolutions of the Security Council, but also the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Test Ban Treaty. And we think they're extremely important in current international relations. So anything which would undermine the regimes of those two treaties is very serious and needs to have a strong response to.
Mr. Churkin, who's also the current president of the Security Council, added that member states were starting work immediately on a new resolution. The French ambassador said its wording should include further sanctions against North Korea. The Japanese ambassador said members should adopt it unanimously.
We made the point that proper response, firm and clear response is the resolution. And we're pleased that today there is no dissenting view among 15 countries that the Security Council need resolution. Show that the condemnation of the act, responsible act by DPRK, and demand fully the compliance with Security Council resolutions, and to ensure that this kind of thing will not happen again.
So, was the UN response stronger than expected? That's what I asked our United Nations correspondent, Laura Trevelyan.
Well, it was pretty much what was expected, but it was agreed very quickly. Really, diplomats met for less than an hour, in fact. And the Chinese, there had been some speculation about whether or not they would go ahead and sign up to a statement which condemned what North Korea had done, because that went beyond the statement already issued by China's foreign ministry. In fact, China did agree to that. And now the statement has said that work will begin on a new resolution. So the aim of certainly Western powers is to try and get a resolution agreed within the week, if they possibly can, with new sanctions or tightened sanctions against North Korea. I guess the question is, will the Chinese go along with that, North Korea's long-time ally and neighbour, and what kind of sanctions are possible?
What's in place at the moment?
Well, what's in place at the moment, and these were first agreed in October 2006, after North Korea first tested a nuclear device, are essentially a ban on the sale of anything to North Korea that can be used for its nuclear weapons program or its ballistic program, the inspection of cargo going to and from North Korea to make sure that there's nothing in it which could be used for a nuclear weapons program, and also a number of companies in North Korea that are thought to have links to the weapons program have had their financial assets abroad frozen. So these are the kind of sanctions that are in place. Potentially, perhaps there are more financial measures that could be agreed. But of course, the overarching question is, will any of this have any effect on North Korea?
Does anyone know why North Korea is doing this, why it's following this particular strategy, irritating everyone, including its near neighbour, China?
Some people think they're trying to grab the attention of the new US president, who has said that he wants a nuclear-free world by demonstrating that they're on the way to becoming a nuclear power. Others think that perhaps there's an ailing leader there, and this is a way of him trying to prop up his legitimacy with his own people. People really don't know whether this means that North Korea has given up on diplomacy altogether, or whether indeed this is, in a way, them trying to seek a route back into the talks.
And that was our UN correspondent, Laura Trevelyan, speaking to me earlier from New York. And if you'd like to stay connected to that story through the day, you can now save bbc.com/news on your mobile phone. The Sri Lankan Defence Secretary Gotabaya Rajapaksa has rejected a Tamil Tiger spokesman's offer to enter a democratic process in the aftermath of their military defeat to government forces. Mr. Rajapaksa told the BBC that the rebels, or the LTTE, can't be trusted, as it wasn't easy for them to give up what he described as terrorism. Earlier, the Sri Lankan government announced local elections in parts of the mainly Tamil north, the first elections to be held there for more than 10 years. Mr. Rajapaksa's comments come just a day after a rebel spokesman said they were willing to give up violence after confirming that their top leadership was killed in recent fighting with security forces. Our Sri Lanka correspondent Anbarasena Thillajan reports.
In an interview with the BBC, Mr. Rajapaksa said he did not believe that the LTTE can enter a democratic process after years of violent activities and there were enough democratic Tamil political parties to represent the Tamils. The Defence Secretary, the senior most civilian official in charge of the war, said, "I am not interested in LTTE at all." Only a few days ago, the visiting United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon had called for a process of national reconciliation that can fully address the legitimate aspirations of the Tamils in Sri Lanka. Mr. Rajapaksa also said the task for security forces was not yet over as they had to recover weapons hidden by the LTTE in the northern and eastern regions and search for any remnants of Tamil Tigers in the jungles. He had also appealed to the Western nations to dismantle the LTTE's overseas network and hand over the leaders to the government who, he said, were trying to purchase arms and ammunition for the LTTE. On reports of intrusive checks against Tamils in the capital Colombo in recent weeks, Mr. Rajapaksa said the Tamil community was not being singled out and that everyone was being stopped at checkpoints, including government officials, for security reasons. But he had hoped the procedures will be eased once normalcy gradually returns to the country.
And Barasana Thirajan in Colombo. You're listening to World Briefing on the BBC World Service. In a moment, Pope Benedict reaches out to the millions of Catholics in China, although many of the faith's bishops and priests are appointed without Vatican approval. First, a reminder of today's main news. Within 24 hours of North Korea's test explosion of a nuclear weapon, the United Nations Security Council has condemned the action. France has called for new sanctions against North Korea. Meanwhile, the United Nations Human Rights Council is meeting in Geneva on Tuesday to begin an emergency session on Sri Lanka. The meeting comes amid criticism from human rights groups that the Council is acting too late and with too little force. During the 26-year-long conflict between the government of Sri Lanka and Tamil separatist groups, both sides were accused of serious human rights violations. Now, human rights groups say those claims must be the subject of an independent investigation and Sri Lanka must allow international aid agencies unimpeded access to an estimated 300,000 people displaced by the fighting. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
The last few months of Sri Lanka's long war were particularly bloody, with thousands of civilians trapped in the conflict zone, widespread allegations of human rights violations by both sides, and no access for aid agencies. But neither of the two resolutions before the UN Human Rights Council calls for an independent investigation. The first, from Sri Lanka itself, backed by China and India, calls on the UN to cooperate with the Sri Lankan government in providing humanitarian aid and asks the international community for financial support to rebuild the country now the fighting is over. The second resolution from Switzerland has the support of European countries. It does call for complete unimpeded access for aid agencies to all persons in need, including the 300,000 people being held in government-run camps. But it too falls short of calling for an independent investigation into human rights abuses.
Imogen Folks. Almost 500 years ago, the Spanish conquered Bolivia and brutally ruled the country for almost 300 years. The first to fight Spanish rule were the people in the city of Sucre, now the constitutional capital. Bolivians are marking the anniversary of the start of this independence struggle. It's the first of a number of Latin American countries which, over the next few years, will be holding independence anniversaries from their colonial rulers. Speaking to The Nation, the Bolivian president Evo Morales said that 200 years later, Latin Americans were engaged in a second struggle for liberation. Candice Piet reports from Sucre.
President Morales said Latin Americans have been oppressed for years and are still fighting against internal and external enemies. A former trade unionist, he said capitalism had put the wealth in the hands of the few, and it was now the enemy that had to be fought. President Morales had decided to make his Independence Day speech not in Sucre, but in the countryside, where one of Bolivia's greatest independence fighters, a woman, Juana Azurduy, had housed her troops. An Aymara Indian and dressed in a ceremonial poncho, he spoke to an audience made up of his indigenous supporters, ministers and foreign ambassadors. He emphasized the role of the Indian independence fighters against colonial rule and said that their sacrifice had not been in vain. There was more awareness now amongst the poorest and more politically oppressed for the need for political change. Meanwhile, in gracious colonial Sucre, where the independence struggle started 200 years ago, a mass was held in the cathedral and there were processions through the streets. The city's church bells were rung at the end of days of dancing displays and school military marching bands in the main square.
Candice Piet there from Bolivia. Now, there are millions of Catholics in China, but many of them belong to an officially recognized Chinese patriotic church that appoints its bishops and priests without the Vatican's approval. Many other Chinese Catholics have kept their allegiance to the Vatican and worship in underground Catholic communities. It's against this backdrop that Pope Benedict sent a letter to all Chinese Catholics, urging them to take urgent, practical steps towards reconciliation and forgiveness. From Rome, David Willey has more.
Pope Benedict's new message to Chinese Catholics, who are estimated to number over 10 million altogether, took the form of some footnotes and additions to a letter that he originally sent them 2 years ago, praising the members of the so-called underground church who've kept their allegiance to Rome intact during more than half a century of communist rule. Beijing broke off formal diplomatic relations with the Vatican back in 1951, and Catholic worship is only permitted in officially recognized churches. While recognizing the Pope as their spiritual leader, the so-called Patriotic Church appoints its own bishops and priests without reference to Rome. Yet millions of Chinese Catholics, no one knows exactly how many, still worship in secret or semi-secret in unofficial Catholic communities, which from time to time are subjected to harassment and persecution by the authorities. The Vatican recently denounced a new wave of arrests of underground priests and bishops. High-level negotiations have been going on during the past year between Vatican officials and Beijing with a view to restoring diplomatic relations, but progress has been slow.
David Willey. Here in Britain, the first female professor of poetry at Oxford University, Ruth Padell, has resigned a matter of days after being appointed. She'd admitted telling journalists about allegations of sexual harassment made against the Nobel laureate Derek Walcott, her main rival for the post, who withdrew from the contest before the vote was held. Here's our arts correspondent, Lawrence Pollard.
Poetry only ever gets in the news with a scandal, and this is a good one, involving sex subterfuge and now a resignation. The professorship of poetry at Oxford is an appointment involving a mere 3 lectures a year and a tiny salary. This year, 3 poets stood for the election, which was held a few weeks ago, and soon the professional rivalries and bitterness, which outsiders are always surprised to see in the supposedly rarefied world of poetry, began to seep out. The most significant poet in the contest, the Nobel laureate Derek Walcott, withdrew in protest at an anonymous letter-writing campaign which drew attention to allegations of sexual harassment made against him decades ago. His main rival, Ruth Padell, said she had nothing to do with the campaign which drove out her rival. But now, emails have emerged in which she seems to brief journalists about Walcott's controversial past. She still claims she's done nothing wrong, but she's resigned anyway. The election will be run again after what the university rather quaintly call a period of reflection, in which we can all reflect on what happens when poets start behaving more like politicians.
Lawrence Pollard reporting. And the main news once again. The United Nations Security Council has unanimously condemned North Korea's latest nuclear test, describing it as a clear violation of its resolution. The condemnation was joined by North Korea's traditional allies, Russia and China. More on that shortly. You're listening to World Briefing here on the BBC World Service.
I'm Roger Hearing with World Business News from the BBC. More democracy means less poverty, one of the findings of a comprehensive survey of views and experiences from across Africa. But we hear from Kenyan flour exporters on a catastrophic drop in their profits during the global recession. And a tour of the financial meltdown with a former Wall Street trader as your guide. All that coming up in the next 10 minutes. Now, one of the largest surveys of public attitudes carried out across the continent of Africa shows a strong correlation between freedom and wealth. In effect, more democracy equals less poverty. The Afrobarometer report, carried out once every 3 years since 1999, looked at 19 countries. The conclusion was that the first 10 years of the 21st century had been sub-Saharan Africa's strongest period of growth in decades. But in 10 countries examined most closely, poverty reduction had closely mirrored increases in political freedom. Professor Leonard Wanchikon of New York University was one of the co-directors of the project.
We just ask people how often they lack some of the basic necessities like cash income, medicine, or food. We also ask them questions about how they feel about democracy in their own country. And we tend to find that there is some kind of correlation between improved perception of democracy and improved living condition as well. I mean, but it's not uniform across the continent. You know, there are countries where clearly democracy hasn't led to better living conditions.
Like what? Like which country?
Benin, for instance, Senegal. Benin and Senegal are two examples. But Kenya and I think Uganda are countries where better political conditions tend to have led to improved living conditions. But those are all perceptions. But we are not claiming that the improved living conditions are due entirely to improved political conditions or increased level of democracy.
And also another interesting factor in all this was a sense from what your study showed that actually things have got quite a lot better. The amount of lived poverty, as you call it, has reduced quite a lot in the last few years.
Yes, but again, it's not uniform. I mean, the main message is that there is still a lot to be done. I mean, for instance, if you take a country like Benin or a country like, you know, Zimbabwe and Mali, up to 90% of the respondents say they lack cash income on a very regular basis. You know, 90%, that's quite high.
Which are the countries you think that are really pushing ahead well? I mean, which are the countries that have, do you think, now the best prospects?
Ghana, Cape Verde, Zambia, Namibia, Botswana, Kenya, obviously South Africa. You know, South Africa is different. But
and those countries, you think the reason is it various reasons, or do they all have something in common, do you think?
Many of those countries have in common the fact that democracy has drastically improve, you know, governments are more accountable, very more transparency in this country, particularly Ghana. I mean, Ghana is one example where we can really see the correlation between improved political condition and improved economic condition, especially reduction in poverty.
Professor Leonard Wanchikon of New York University on the Afrobarometer report. One of the countries that survey found was reducing poverty, as you heard, was Kenya. But one of Kenya's flagship exports has been suffering very badly in the current recession. Fresh-cut flowers are regularly air-freighted to Europe from Kenya, but earnings have shrunk dramatically this year, as I heard from Hasid Shah of the Fresh Produce Exporters Association of Kenya.
We have three main products that make up our industry, and we have approximately $1 billion of earnings that flowers, fruits, and vegetables earn for the country. And what happened is up until August, September last year, everything was quite good, but subsequently there's been a drop in purchases as consumers go off purchasing luxury, non-essential items. So flower sales have dropped 35%. And then veg is down about 30%.
How has that affected your members?
Quite significantly, because it's a mainstay. It's a big industry that employs about 150,000 people directly, and it's really affected everyone's cash flows because there's been a drop in consumption and a drop in pricing.
Have some people gone out of business?
Everybody's tried to hold on and try and get, you know, through your winter period. And everybody's tried to hold on to, you know, the big selling days, which are your Valentine's, your Mother's Day, etc. Now that we're coming into the European summer and the last Mother's Day over last, 10 days ago, we'll now start seeing an issue coming through on some farms. So we start seeing layoffs, we're seeing people cutting back and just trying to become a lot more efficient. So, yes, we are going to see problems over the next 3-4 months.
What sort of advice are you giving, then, to your members at the moment?
I think at the moment everybody's just being very prudent about what they produce and what they ship. Everybody's being very careful about the costs of production, the air freight, and how they market. So at every stage, everybody's having to look into their businesses very carefully and evaluate what makes money and what doesn't make money, and if necessary, reduce the areas that everybody's doing. What also hit us quite badly was the exchange rates. Most of our earnings are in pounds and in euros, and all our costs are dollar-based. And when the pound went from $2 to the pound and the euro went from 160 to 140, then we had a 25% wipeout in our dollar values. And all our costs are in dollars, and they've only just started to go down now, 9 months later. So I think everybody's just now going to try and tighten the belts, try and get to the off-season, and hopefully from October the markets will pick up again and people start to spend again.
Hasid Shah, a rather poor line, I'm afraid, they're from Kenya. Normally this time we'd be telling you what's been happening on the share markets, but on Monday both Britain and the United States had public holidays, so the markets were closed. But meanwhile, what about Wall Street as a tourist destination? And who better to take you on a tour of Wall Street than a former trader? Andrew Lewin used to work for Deutsche Bank, specialising in the very products we now call toxic assets. After losing his job, he found a way to make money showing tourists some of the sights of the financial meltdown. Michel Fleury reports.
So, you know, welcome to Wall Street.
After losing his job as a trader, Andrew Lewin made an unusual career move.
You know, my name's Andrew Lewin. I'll be your guide for today. In the next 2 hours or so, I'll be taking you into the financial crisis.
He still works in New York's battered financial district, but these days it's as a tour guide. As well as personal anecdotes, he shows customers where it all happened, starting outside the New York Stock Exchange.
This building was built in 1903 for $4 million. I started giving tours to friends that come onto Wall Street when they visit me from, you know, different areas of the country, different areas of the world. So I give them tours of Wall Street. This is where, this place where I live and work.
And Andrew is the ultimate Wall Street insider.
I became a trader, a bond trader, specifically a CDO trader. You guys heard of toxic assets, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay, toxic assets.
One of the stops on the tour is outside his old employer, Deutsche Bank, where he traded collateralized debt obligations until the market collapsed, the very financial instruments that were at the heart of this crisis. So do people on the tour ever point the finger of blame at him?
They haven't done it to my face. I mean, maybe they have thought that I share part of the blame. And I basically, I give people the grand picture of kind of the crisis and how it happened.
Andrew's customers pay $40 each for the tour. At those rates, he's making a lot less money out of Wall Street than he once did.
And that was Andrew Lewin, former Wall Street trader, taking our very own Michel Fleury around the sights and sounds of the places where he and his ilk made their money and, I guess, lost it as well. Don't forget the latest edition of World Business News, always available on our website. You just go to the web address, and that is bbcworldservice.com/business.
BBC World Service.
20 million people suffer from type 1 diabetes. One of them is Justin Webb's son.
Living in America, Sam has access to insulin and to healthcare support, meaning that he can, injections apart, live something approaching a normal life.
The BBC's North America editor reveals how he and his family are coming to terms with the disease, how lack of resources can make diabetes deadly to children born into poverty, and on the search for an elusive cure.
Intervention in diabetic mice reverses the disease.
Reverses the disease?
Yeah.
You've cured mice of diabetes?
Yeah. So if you're a mouse, we get you covered.
A personal look at a global condition. Diabetes, a silent killer. Starts Monday, the 15th of June on the BBC World Service.
There are hundreds of BBC documentaries and investigations ready to download at bbcworldservice.com. Just click Documentaries for our highlights or to explore the archive.
You're listening to World Briefing on the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and after a summary of the latest world news, we'll be hearing more about the reaction of the UN Security Council to North Korea's latest nuclear test. The Church of Scotland reverses its policy on gay priests as the anger of traditionalists grows, and why the sport of cricket is causing tensions involving immigrant communities in Italy. That's all after a summary of the main world news.
BBC News with Michael Poles. The United Nations Security Council has unanimously condemned North Korea's latest nuclear test, describing it as a clear violation of its resolutions. North Korea's traditional allies, Russia and China, joined the condemnation. It came less than 24 hours after North Korea confirmed that it had exploded another nuclear device, bigger than the one it tested in 2006. The United States ambassador said her country wanted a resolution with strong measures. The authorities in Brazil say almost 380,000 people can't go home because of floods. The Brazilian government has released more than $400 million in aid for the victims. The Mexican government has launched a campaign to revive tourism following a big drop in the number of visitors since the scare over swine flu. Leading actors, musicians and sportsmen are involved. The Sri Lankan Defence Secretary has rejected an offer from the remaining Tamil Tiger leaders to enter the democratic process following the rebels' military defeat last week. He said the Tamil Tigers could not be trusted. The first woman professor of poetry at Oxford University, Ruth Padell, has resigned after 10 days in office. It follows reports that she alerted journalists to sexual harassment allegations against her main rival for the post, Derek Walcott. Ms. Padell insisted she'd acted in good faith. Mr. Walcott denies any wrongdoing. The Church of Scotland has decided to ban the ordination of homosexuals for 2 years. The move comes 2 days after the Church of Scotland approved the appointment of an openly gay minister. The Sudanese army says 20 of its soldiers have been killed repelling a rebel attack on a base in Darfur. It said more than 40 rebel fighters also died. Police in Brazil have foiled an attempt to use a model aircraft to smuggle mobile phones into a prison. They stopped a car near a jail in Sao Paulo state and found a remote-controlled helicopter attached to a basket carrying 9 phones. And that's the BBC News.
You're listening to World Briefing on the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and now back to our main news. North Korea's nuclear test has triggered widespread international condemnation. In New York, the United Nations Security Council